From the Moan Broadcast Center, it's Take Two. I'm Libby Dankman in for A. Martinez. Ahead of the November election, new research on how COVID-19 could be impacting voters' choices in November. And it does not look good for the current administration. Plus, several organizations that run charter schools in Los Angeles got PPP loans.
So critics would ask, why does a publicly funded school need a potentially forgivable loan from the federal government?
It's all ahead on Take Two. From 89.3 KBCC, this is Take Two. I'm Libby Dankman in for A. Martinez today. Thanks for joining us. Coming up, the story of one of LA's first mayors and his unconventional approach to law enforcement. It was really the Wild Wild West in Los Angeles circa 1850. Plus, we'll dig into why charter schools in LA are getting loans from the Paycheck Protection Program. That's all ahead. But first, with less than 100 days before the November election, there's a lot on the line for President Trump and congressional Republicans hoping to hold on to their seats. New research shows they face an uphill battle in counties where COVID-19 deaths are high. And that could have big effects on the most contested down-ballot races in the country, including right here in Southern California. With us now is the co-researcher of that study, Lynn Vavrick. She's a professor of American politics and public policy at UCLA and co-author of Identity Crisis, the 2016 presidential campaign and the battle for the meaning of America. Thanks for coming on, Lynn.
Thanks for having me.
Your research breaks down county by county how voters are feeling about President Trump and his Democratic challenger, Joe Biden. For example, in a place like Wayne County, Michigan, what did the numbers show and how does that relate to the pandemic?
Particularly, we're looking at the death count due to the virus in the last 60 days. And that's a place where deaths have quadrupled in the last 2 months. And so the hit that Donald Trump and Republicans on the federal running for federal office are taking there is quite severe. The gap between Republicans and Democrats is increasing by more than a point in a place like Wayne County, Michigan.
And how do you know that COVID was the cause of this shift in voter sentiment, not another outside factor?
We have data from over 330,000 interviews that span an entire year. We are able to compare counties today to sentiment in that same county yesterday and a year ago. So we can think about a doubling of cases of deaths in a county, and that's going to increase the gap between Joe Biden and Donald Trump by about a third of a percentage point. And that might sound like a small number, but going back to Michigan, which we've been talking about a lot, Michigan, the state of Michigan in 2016 was decided by 0.2 of a point.
And meanwhile, when you look at some remote places of the country like Wyoming, are you seeing a connection between COVID-19 deaths and support for Republicans there?
So there are some places in the country where the virus has had much less of an impact. And so Wyoming is one of those places. So those low COVID deaths in places like Wyoming, support there for Republicans is staying strong. But in counties where the deaths are increasing, the support for Republicans are decreasing.
There's no real mystery in California how, as a state, we will vote in a presidential election these days. But according to your research, when you look down ballot at those running for election in the Senate and the House, what did you find when it comes to COVID cases and congressional races?
Sort of surprisingly, voters seem to be holding the Republican Party writ large accountable for what's happening with COVID across the country. And so for the House of Representatives, the trends are very similar. There's even a little bit of evidence that for the Senate and the House, they're paying an even steeper penalty than President Trump.
There are many contested congressional seats here in Southern California as we look towards the November election, particularly in places like Orange County, which is now more purple than historically it had been red. I'm thinking of the rematch between Democratic Congressman Gil Cisneros and Republican Young Kim in the 39th, particularly. He won that seat by a very slim margin in 2018, just 3 points. What does your research suggest about Democrats in Southern California who got elected by slim margins just a few years ago, and what the coronavirus cases here could suggest.
The fact that cases in places like Orange County are increasing, and there are an increasing number of deaths in Orange County now related to COVID, that is bad news for Republicans, for Republican incumbents, but just Republicans in general on the ballot. In those races, like the one you're talking about, where the margin was narrow, if I were the Republican in those races, I would be worried. You're the Republican in that race. You are in a worse position now electorally than you were a year ago, for sure, but even 3 or 4 months ago.
We're talking with Lynn Vavreck, professor of American politics and public policy at UCLA, about her research into coronavirus deaths in given counties across the United States and the impact on electoral chances for Republicans and really voter sentiment towards Republicans for the 2020 election. Lynn, coronavirus is really surging in places like Los Angeles. It did surge in New York, and partly that's because of these dense populations that larger cities have. In most cities, local leaders tend to be Democratic. In your study, do voters tend to hold all incumbents responsible for what's going on in the country? Or is there really just a party line split from what you're seeing? And why do you think that is?
You can see that that is happening. If you look at governor approval ratings, they started out very high. Governors are trying to solve these problems for people. But we've moved across time now, and cases are going up and deaths are going up, and you can see those governor approval ratings going down. But what's also true is there are partisan differences at the same time. As we move across time, concern is going to decline for everyone. But it is going to decline more for Republicans than for Democrats. And that, in large part, is driven by what's coming out of the White House.
And ultimately, it appears to you, at least, that folks are going straight to the top when it comes to accountability for what they perceive as policy failures that may contribute to rising cases in their region. Your research framed this pandemic as a wartime issue, and people are holding the president accountable in the similar way that you would during a traditional war. Are you surprised that that's the way people are behaving? And, you know, what do you think is behind that?
I'm not surprised. Even the president saw that this battle was an epic battle, like a war, and he declared himself a wartime president. And now the casualties of that war are, in a sense, having an effect on his reelection prospects and his party's reelection prospects, just as they would be if this were conventional war. People always think about, you know, when presidents go to war, there is this, quote, rally around the flag moment where everyone wants to support the troops. And I suspect that in that moment that Trump said, I am a wartime president, that's what he was thinking about, rally around the flag, rally around the president. And then, as you say, time went on and things got more chaotic, levels of anxiety increased. And then that rally around the flag goes away.
Lynn Vavreck is a professor of American politics and public policy at UCLA. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Libby.
Moving on, mail-in voting will play a critical role in the 2020 election, especially as hope of returning to normal by November continues to fade. California elections officials say they're well-equipped to handle the millions of ballots on the way this fall, but that doesn't mean the system is without its potential hang-ups. One comes in the form of the struggling Postal Service, which is planning to scale back operations in an effort to save money. The other is sometimes user error, a missed signature, or a late ballot. The California Voter Foundation, along with USC's Center for Inclusive Democracy, have been examining rejected ballots in three California counties. They recently released some of their findings in an effort to get voters thinking about their ballots early. Kim Alexander is founder and president of the nonprofit and nonpartisan California Voter Foundation. She's with me now. Hi, Kim. Welcome to Take Two.
Hi, Libby. Thanks for having me.
Good to hear your voice, as always. Before we get some of the results of your study, I want to get your reaction to a tweet put out by President Trump earlier today. He claims in his Twitter missive that universal mail-in voting will make this the most inaccurate and fraudulent election in history. As an expert in mail-in voting, like you are, Kim, what is your take on today's remarks?
I think the president is hoping we'll talk about these remarks and not about the remarks that his predecessor, Barack Obama, delivered today at John Lewis's eulogy, which is, you know, what I enjoyed hearing today. I really think a lot of these comments are meant to distract and meant to cause voters to be fearful and to despair. And so my message to your listeners and anyone else who's been hearing and worrying about these tweets is, you know, don't fall for it. We need everybody to vote, and nothing should stop you from voting, and certainly not these misleading comments being made by our president.
Yeah, we heard President Obama briefly on the BBC before we started here talking about the dangers of undermining the election and undermining confidence in the election, speaking from the memorial service for Congressman John Lewis. On the subject of President Trump, he recently appointed Louis DeJoy as Postmaster General. Earlier this month, DeJoy announced cost-cutting changes for the post office that are apparently going to lead to a slowdown in mail delivery. How likely is it that a slowdown like that would affect mail-in ballots come November?
Yeah, this is something we definitely do need to talk about, and we need Congress to step up and make sure that the post office has funding. That's one of the concerns here, and that the president does the same. There is a lot of concern in the elections community about the directive that's come out from the Postmaster General, and concern that it's going to slow down vote by mail ballot return. And, you know, we've been encouraging voters to recognize that we call these vote by mail ballots, but that doesn't mean you have to return it by mail. And in fact, we prefer voters to return their ballots in person. There's a lot of reasons for that. One is you make sure that the ballot is received on time. There's no question about it. If you drop it in a drop box or take it to a polling place or voting site before 8 p.m. on election day, it's going to get counted. But the other advantage is, you know, one of the top reasons why some ballots get rejected is because voters forget to sign the envelope. And if you take it to a voting site, there will be somebody there who can look it over, make sure that you've signed and dated your envelope, and make sure that it will get counted.
I think that's huge, too. Your research into the ballots that got rejected in Sacramento, San Mateo, and Santa Clara counties, you found about 1.7% of vote-by-mail ballots cast in California in those counties had been rejected since 2010. And as you mentioned—
Just a quick correction.
Yeah, go ahead.
Our study found that statewide over the last 10 years, on average, 1.7% of all vote-by-mail ballots cast in California are rejected. Those counties, we looked at just the rejection rate in the November 2018 election, and Sacramento and Santa Clara's rejection rate in that election was 0.7%, and San Mateo's was 1%.
Got it. Thank you for that correction. Sure. So when we look at that percentage of ballots being rejected statewide, you mentioned people not signing. What else is a big reason that ballots get rejected?
Well, lateness is the top reason in most counties why ballots get rejected. And there was a great study done, an investigative piece by the Associated Press that Michael Bled authored just a couple weeks ago, that found that there were over 102,000 ballots in California in the March primary that were rejected, and that lateness was certainly the top reason in March why we saw these ballots rejected. And what we found in Sacramento that was really fascinating to me, and really something I learned from our study that I think is really significant is, you know, we have a 3-day grace period for ballot return in California. So the way the law works, as long as your ballot is postmarked by election day and received within 3 days of the election, it will get counted. And for the November election, the governor's executive order and emergency legislation that was enacted recently extends that grace period to 17 days. So that's a good news that even if we have these post office delays and concerns about slow mail delivery, there is this generous grace period, but it still has to be postmarked by election day. And what we saw in Sacramento County, we looked at 3 elections, all the late ballots in 2018 and most of the late ballots in March 2020, and found that overwhelmingly these ballots were rejected for lateness, not because they arrived too late, but because they were postmarked too late to count. And most of them were postmarked the day after the election. So what we suspect is happening is that voters are putting their ballots into blue mailboxes or dropping them off at post offices after the mail's been picked up, after the post offices are closed, and they're sitting there.
Yes, after that last pickup, I can totally see that happening, going to the corner, dropping it in the box, but oops, it's after, you know, 4 o'clock or whatever the last pickup was. You mentioned in your research that there is a connection you found between ballots rejected and the age of the person mailing it in. What trends were you seeing?
Yeah, in all 3 counties that we looked at, we saw the same trend, which was that young voters, age 18 to 24, were the smallest group of vote-by-mail voters, smallest percentage of vote-by-mail voters, but the greatest percentage of voters to have their ballots rejected. This was the same across all 3 counties. And, you know, young voters have 3 factors working against them. They are new to voting, and they are not accustomed to using the mail, and they're not used to using a signature as a way to verify themselves. So these are really big challenges we need to help California's young voters overcome and help them vote successfully.
So with the time we have left, what tips do you have for voters who want to be sure their mail-in ballot gets counted this year? I hear you saying, be sure that it's either postmarked or you're dropping it in a drop box, right?
Yeah, if you want to use the mail to return your ballot, it is postage paid, which is super convenient. The recommendation is to mail it a week in advance. And if you can't get it in the mail a week in advance and you're voting close to the election, you really should take it somewhere in person. Every county has a drop box at the county election office. And under California law, you can return your ballot to any voting site or drop box in the whole state, and it will get to your home county and get counted. The other tip we want to make sure voters know is that people don't know what their signature on file looks like. And that's the other big reason that ballots get rejected, is the signature on the ballot envelope doesn't sufficiently match their voter registration signature. So if you're not sure what your signature looks like, and most of us don't remember what it looked like when we registered, you can look at your driver's license or state ID if you have one and make your signature look like your signature on your license. If you ever registered online or your registration was processed through the Department of Motor Vehicles, that is your signature on file. So that's, we want voters to know they should look at that, especially young voters.
Kim Alexander is president and founder of the California Voter Foundation, a nonprofit that aims to improve the voting process. Kim, thanks again for being here.
Thanks, Libby. It was fun.
Coming up on Take Two, we'll hear from the council member who introduced a controversial measure in LA City Council to reinstate cleanups near certain homeless shelters. The mayor signaled yesterday that he's not on board. More on that coming up next.
Thank you.
Back now with Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and on the KPCC app. I'm Libby Denkman, politics reporter sitting in for A. Martinez. Yesterday, the Los Angeles City Council held an at times impassioned meeting in which they debated whether to resume what are called comprehensive cleanups near certain homeless shelters. Those cleanups had been put on pause because of the pandemic. The council voted 10-4 to start them up again, but there's been major pushback from advocacy groups who say the cleanups terrorize houseless people and increase the risk of spreading COVID-19. There's also a lot of questions about what happens next here. At a press conference yesterday, Mayor Garcetti said just because the council voted doesn't mean the city will actually resume these sweeps.
And I will say I've seen some very successful models of this where folks in encampments know that. They're prepared, just as we know when our trash is going to be collected if we're living in housing, that folks on the street will know when there's a cleaning coming, something that benefits them as much as it benefits the city at large. So I look forward to those discussions. But to be clear, there's not been a city direction on that yet. It requires conversations and consultation with our public health officials.
Conversations and consultations. Well, Councilman Joe Buscaino introduced the measure to reinstate Care Plus cleanups in the areas near the city's Abridge Home shelters. And he joins me now. Councilman, thank you very much for being on Take Two today.
Thank you, Libby, for having me.
So just to set the stage for folks who don't know, what does the sanitation department do in a Care Plus cleanup?
So the Care Plus is the city's enhanced cleanup procedure. The cleanup is noticed, given 24 to 72 hours. Outreach workers reach out to the encampment population before the cleanup takes place. And they remove bulky items and a much larger volume of trash.
And the vote yesterday was specifically to restart these in zones near these Abridge Home shelters. But as you mentioned, the Care Plus cleanups that are going to be restarted maybe because of this vote, that involves moving bulky items. But right now, the city sanitation department, sanitation can already pick up trash and do spot cleaning around encampments currently. So this was really to allow the sanitation to come in, post a notice and ask folks to either move their items, or if they don't move them, then sanitation can come in and move things like tents, carts, stuff like that.
Correct. A large, bulky items, which we've seen in every corner of the city of Los Angeles, which we haven't done in 4 months. So due to the COVID pandemic back in March 17th, under the guidance of the county public health officials, the city council agreed to halt the comprehensive cleanups. And I said, hold on. Now that I have two 100-bed shelters opening, one in Wilmington and one in San Pedro, what we're finding are people moving into the Bridge Home shelters, which is fantastic as planned. But they have left all of their trash behind, which has been accumulating for 4 months. I'm just really, really proud, Libby, of my team. We have been on the ground. We know the names of these individuals. We know their stories. We know who's in a relationship or not. These CDC guidelines clearly don't apply here.
Yeah, I want to get to that, Councilman. Sorry, yeah. Just to set the table for listeners who don't know, the CDC has advised, and I'll quote from its website, unless housing units are available, quote, do not clear encampments during community spread of COVID-19. Clearing encampments can cause people to disperse throughout the community, which increases the potential for disease spread. So, you know, the question, of course, that you know is coming and was raised at council yesterday is why restart a policy that forces homeless people to take down their tents and move around when we are asking everyone to stay home for public health concerns?
Well, we have a place for them to go now, which is fantastic. You know, we heard from the CDC, as you mentioned, because of COVID, people should be sheltering in place as much as possible. But to ensure that people are allowed to keep their tents up during the day and they don't have to move their tents. But in this case, I'm proud of the fact that my community said yes to homeless solutions. We are moving on. We just opened two 100-bed shelters. We have also 100-bed shelter in Watts, rounding our three Bridge Home sites. We also have a navigation center where they can store their property. We have learned also that, you know, the homeless individuals who are in a shelter go in, get the resources, go to bed there at night. But during the day, they go back outside into their encampment. And that's not good for the homeless individual. We're doing a disservice to the client. We're doing a disservice to the residents who said yes to the solution.
So you're saying that sorry to interrupt, but just because we have limited time, you're saying that the tents that we see, and you know, it can be dozens and dozens of tents outside of these bridge home shelters, they're not necessary for people to live in. I mean, do you really think that there are enough beds for homeless people right now in Los Angeles? I mean, and that they actually don't need to be sleeping in a tent on the street?
Well, I'm speaking on behalf of my district. You know, we have targeted two encampment zones and a third one, Alameda McCoy in Harbor City, which I encourage your viewers to see what a mess that is. So what we've done here, this is a whole reason why we have the Bridge Home Shelter, is to provide them a place to go. And we are doing that. In fact, we have about 16 beds left available in the San Pedro and 20 beds available in the Wilmington site. We are doing what with the outreach, we are moving individuals from the encampments and sidewalks into a Bridge Home Shelter. The problem now, and the reason for my motion is to restart up our comprehensive cleanups, is that, you know, we need to pick up the mess and the trash that hasn't been picked up in 4 months. Just imagine your trash not being picked up at home for 4 months. What public health, public safety issue that.
But
that
trash
would be.
Trash can be picked up right now under the current sanitation guidelines. The thing
not
that
necessarily
can't be done
That's
is
the
moving
difference.
The bulky items. Go ahead.
Yeah. So the difference is, and you make a good point, where you have spot cleaning, and the care teams these last 4 months have just been picking up litter. You know, and if you look at these encampments in and around the Bridge Home, we're talking the Bridge Home special zones that we've agreed upon. We're talking large, bulky pallets, trash, metal, empty sinks, spoiled food, and yes, in certain cases, buckets of feces and urine. We already have a public health situation in our city, COVID-19. We can't afford another one.
I mean, you know what you heard from the folks who called into public comment yesterday, and if you talk to caseworkers who also work with the homeless day in and day out, they say that these types of cleanups that ask the people to move their tents for 2 hours to up to a full day are this huge disruption in people's lives. They often lose important documentation or medication as part of these cleanups. And there's a lot of trust that's broken with caseworkers, and it really sets people back when they're forced to move in this way. What is your response to that sentiment that these cleanups are doing more harm than good?
They're wrong. Possibly because they haven't experienced and seen, like I have and my staff have seen, with these comprehensive cleanups. Clearly, if you're given 2 to 3 days notice, you know a cleanup is coming. You know the belongings you need to take with you. Listen, we have to keep in mind of the people we serve. We represent everybody, including the resident, the single mom who has to walk her daughter to school and step over the trash and the feces. Think about our businesses who are struggling and having these encampments in and around their business locations. We also have to think about the homeless individuals, where we've seen an increase of homeless individuals last year being more victimized, of an increase of homeless people dying in our streets last year. So to say the folks who called in yesterday that this is a sweep is absolutely wrong. I actually encourage them to come to my district and experience firsthand how the Comprehensive Care Plus teams work. See how our sanitation workers are sorting, you know, urine and feces from soiled mattresses, and see how that works. Again, the whole purpose of us doing this right is having our social service providers on the ground prior to the cleanup, reaching out 72 to 24 hours in advance. And by the way, we have to remind ourselves, this is a commitment that the mayor made to the communities and neighborhoods who said yes to a Bridge Home. that with a bridge home, you're going to get comprehensive cleanups every single week. And we cannot backtrack on that.
And I think that that was a theme that we heard coming up again and again from several council members, was that the communities who accepted a bridge home shelters in their neighborhoods now feel like there's been a promise broken if there wasn't cleanup accomplished around these shelters. But, you know, of course, our houseless neighbors are also members of the community. And, you know, Los Angeles has broken its promise to try to get them housing, try to get them services, and to treat them oftentimes in the history of the city, to treat them with compassion. So do you think that, you know, at this point during a pandemic, that this is the appropriate time to kick this into high gear, you know, and why is this the appropriate time versus waiting until a public health concern like the pandemic has settled down and, you know, we can wrap our arms around this problem?
It's a lot safer to be in a bridge home site today than in a sidewalk. I have beds that are available in my district in these two encampment zones that we are working around the clock. So that's how we're leading with compassion, is saying yes to solutions.
I hear you saying you have beds available, but, you know, citywide, a federal judge has ruled that Los Angeles does not have adequate services available for homeless people. And that's been, you know, the subject of a long court case, you know, all the way up to the Supreme Court, looking at whether or not Los Angeles can force people to move and get off the street if there's not adequate housing for people. And there's also an order in place from earlier this year about moving bulky items. It's called Municipal Code 5611. And some council members who voted against your motion have raised this. You know, if we as a city are not allowed, according to this federal judge, to move bulky items, how is your motion legal and will it actually have any impact?
Now, let me correct you. We can move bulky items with adequate notice, and that has not changed, and that will not change. You have 24 to 72 hour notice. You have to notify the individuals in encampments, bring in the social service workers on the ground. That will not change, and that will continue to happen under the Care Plus comprehensive cleanup. The other question we have to ask ourselves is, what are neighboring cities doing? Because the city of Los Angeles cannot solve homeless alone. This is why the policy is confined to areas in and around the bridge home only. We're not talking, this is a citywide effort here. And this is where Mayor Garcetti, who I spoke to after his comments last night, his comments were reflected on a citywide comprehensive cleanup strategy. We're not talking about a Care Plus mobilizing citywide. And we're talking on what we promised the neighborhoods who said yes to a bridge home, those specific zones. And for me, it's the Wilmington area and the San Pedro area. And also, I was the only council member last year to remind your listening audience that I asked the governor to call for a statewide state of emergency on homelessness. Well, it took COVID-19 to see this issue as a statewide state of emergency. So with that, we are moving quickly on looking at options, at all options for me in my council district, from Watts to San Pedro, whether it's pallet housing, whether it's bridge home housing, permanent supportive housing. If you're looking at the safe parking location, safe tent location, for me, it's all options are on the table, because I'm tired of managing this issue. I want to solve homelessness in my district and throughout the city. But I'm also asking, Libby, if any other local leaders who are listening in neighboring cities throughout LA County, remember there's 88 cities, please do your part. In fact, come to my district and see how effective the Bridge Home Program has been.
Mm. Joe Buscaino,
you need to do your part as well.
I just want to reset here, council member, in our last couple of minutes. Council member Joe Buscaino is the member of the city council in Los Angeles who presented the measure that passed yesterday, 10-4, to restart comprehensive cleanups around the city's Bridge Home shelters. This was opposed by 4 council members, and the mayor made comments at a press conference yesterday that indicated that this might not not go forward as was planned by the motion that Mr. Buscaino introduced. And so, Councilman, you're saying that you had conversations with the mayor. The mayor says just because the council voted doesn't mean this is actually going to happen. What have those conversations been like, and what does this mean on the ground going forward?
Again, I believe the mayor was confused. This is a policy. Let me reiterate. This is a policy that was approved by the council yesterday. That, again, is confined to only areas around the bridge home shelters, not a citywide policy. As you know, we're in the middle of a lawsuit, the LA Alliance, and activists and the business folks with the city and county under the direction of Judge Dave Carter. We're looking forward to continuing those discussions to move quickly on solutions to homelessness throughout the county and our city.
Councilmember Joe Buscaino is, the member who was part of a very contentious meeting yesterday, presenting a motion to restart comprehensive cleanups around the city's Abridge Home shelters, and he joined me for this conversation. I thank you very much, sir, for coming on Take Two.
Thanks, Libby. Give A my best, okay, when he comes back.
I will do that.
Thanks for having me.
A will be back next week. I'm Libby Denkman. We'll be back with more Take Two after this. Coming up, the federal government made billions of dollars of loans available to businesses struggling to survive because of COVID-19. But should that include charter schools, which are already getting emergency taxpayer money? What our education reporter Kyle Stokes has dug up, that's next on Take Two. We're back with Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Libby Denkman in for A. Martinez. Last spring, Congress approved more than $650 billion for a loan program to help small businesses weather the coronavirus recession. That was the Paycheck Protection Program, or PPP. 2 months ago, KPCC's Kyle Stokes found out that alongside all the flower shops and bars and barber shops, charter schools were also receiving PPP loans. Since then, Kyle's been digging through the data, and he has found out these PPP loans to publicly funded schools in the Los Angeles Unified School District are quite common. Kyle's here to tell us what he found. Hey, Kyle.
Hi, Libby.
So what got you so interested in charter schools getting these loans in the first place?
Well, so there's been this question since the Paycheck Protection Program's inception, right? Have the loans been getting to their intended recipients, which are small employers who are struggling with the uncertain economic conditions that we're living through to do things, you know, basic things like make payroll and cover their rent? For example, you know, there was all this outcry about restaurant chains like Shake Shack and Potbelly Sandwiches receiving PPP loans despite being, you know, huge publicly traded companies. Now, in the case of charter schools, we should be clear. Legally, charters can qualify for PPP. Charter schools are run by nonprofit organizations, which are eligible for PPP loans. But at the same time, charter schools also get almost all of their funding from the state, and the state has not stopped funding public schools during the pandemic. So critics would ask, why does a publicly funded school need a potentially forgivable loan from the federal government?
Sure, a lot of us think of the mom and pop shops needing help, but maybe not a school that gets, again, taxpayer money. But what's the counterargument to that, Kyle? Why do charter schools need the money?
some charter school advocates would actually say that their schools are exactly the type of organization that needs a PPP loan the most, a small employer in many cases with a limited ability to borrow money at affordable rates. All schools have taken on extraordinary costs, as we all know. They're running meal distributions, they're buying laptops for kids. But a big school district can also borrow money at a rate that a charter school probably can't, because charter schools are so much smaller and can't throw their weight around as much with a bank. So a charter school, probably not going to be able to beat the 1% interest rate of a PPP loan. Now, a charter school critic would probably come back there and say the federal government also sent a bunch of emergency money to LAUSD charter schools, something like $33 million to cover emergency expenses at LAUSD charters alone. And to these critics, these PPP loans probably feel like double dipping if they're going to a charter school.
Mm. We're talking with KPCC's Kyle Stokes about why so many charter schools in Los Angeles have received loans from the Paycheck Protection Program. And Kyle, you've been digging through the data. How many charters did receive PPP loans?
So I found 50 different PPP loans to organizations that run 133 charter schools in the Los Angeles Unified School District. 133 schools, that's more than half of the charter schools in LAUSD. And that is a consistent finding somewhat with the organization that it's called In the Public Interest and Parents United for Public Schools. Both of those organizations did a much bigger statewide analysis, and they found something pretty similar, that about half of the charter schools all across the state received a PPP loan. Now, here in LAUSD, by digging through school board documents, I'm able to say pretty safely that at least $73 million in loans went to charter school recipients. But the federal government lists each grant, each loan, as a range. So it's possible that the total of PPP money to LAUSD charters is much bigger, something more like $113 million. That's the upper end of the range.
Wow. We've reported a lot about how small businesses had trouble accessing these loans, especially in the early days of PPP. What about charter schools? How did they fare?
A handful of them were able to get some of the loans in the early going. When the application window opened on April 3rd, obviously, as we all kind of remember, the PPP loans ran out really quick. Small businesses had trouble accessing the money. But since April 24th, when the president and Congress injected more money into the program, things have been a lot less frantic. There's still about $100 billion in loans left. Now, the biggest PPP loan we were able to identify to an LAUSD charter was approved before April 24th. This was an $8.3 million loan to Granada Hills Charter High School back on April 11th. And there were 13 other charters that did get loans in those sort of frantic early days, but most of them, 36 out of the 50, were made after that second round of funding was approved.
Like you said before, the federal government did provide some emergency money for schools. When you get right down to it, why have so many charter schools in the Los Angeles area access these loans?
Well, the main reason that charters are going after this money is uncertainty. They know that they're going to get their funding from the state. They just don't know when. A lot of schools, including charters, are going to have to borrow money because the state is balancing its budget by delaying payments to schools. So schools are facing huge potential cash flow problems coming down the pike. And PPP loans are already proving useful for charter schools, just so that they can like keep the lights on until the state next payments arrive. One charter executive told me that his school wouldn't have been able to make their payroll for June if not for the PPP loan that his school got back in May.
You brought up Shake Shack earlier. They qualified for a PPP loan because each of their locations had fewer than 500 employees, which was kind of a loophole in the law. There are some huge charter chains in Los Angeles. Did any of those receive PPP loans?
Not really. There were two loans to some big charter organizations, Green Dot Public Schools and an organization called Puck National, which through three different entities runs about a dozen charter schools in Los Angeles. But the loans that they got through the PPP program were relatively small, and they were to support their back office operations. But most of the big charter chains in Los Angeles, Alliance for College Ready Public Schools, that's LAUSD's biggest chain with 25 schools. they didn't receive PPP loans. Neither did a charter school network called KIPP, which runs schools all over California. They received them apparently in other states, but they didn't receive them in California.
That's KPCC education reporter Kyle Stokes. Thank you very much, Kyle.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Take Two. I'm Libby Denkman in for A. Martinez. A will be back next week. And if you want to hear more about the Paycheck Protection Program in Los Angeles, KPCC's Emily Guerin looked at where the businesses were that received the most loans in Los Angeles. And it may not surprise you that the PPP loan businesses were concentrated on the west side in wealthier, wider areas of the city. You can check out Emily's reporting on LAist.com. Coming up, Take Two rolls on with a trip back in time. Stay with us.
Soon I will be done with the trouble of this world, with the trouble of this world, with the trouble of this world. Soon I will be done with the trouble of this world. I'm going home to be with God. There'll be no more weeping and wailing.
Back now with Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Libby Denkman in for A. Martinez. It's Thursday, which means time to hop in our time machines and head to Los Angeles circa 1854.
California, land of romance.
There is probably no single area holding so much of charm and beauty and the good things of life as Southern California.
Once a sleepy ranch town, now home to the stars of Tinseltown, the captains of industry and over 1 million men, women, and children.
There are boys and girls from the large cities and small towns. Each brings his dreams, his hopes, and his ambitions.
For this Throwback Thursday, we're talking about Mayor Stephen C. Foster. He's considered the first American mayor of Los Angeles, and his approach to law enforcement was reflective of a time when California really was the Wild West. To learn more about this curious figure of LA's past, A. Martinez spoke with Robert Peterson. He hosts the podcast Hidden History Los Angeles. Peterson kicked off the conversation by outlining Stephen C. Foster's ascent to mayorhood.
Stephen Foster became mayor of Los Angeles during the transition from Mexican to American rule. So travel back to the mid-19th century, Americans took Los Angeles and California from Mexico. And originally, it was under military rule. So in 1847, Stephen C. Foster was appointed alcalde, or mayor of Los Angeles, by the military-appointed governor of Los Angeles to basically take over from the dissolved Mexican government.
All right. Now, the LAPD wasn't officially established until 1869. So how was justice carried out back then?
Well, justice was carried out by informal measures. Mm-hmm. So you had volunteer groups, and then you also had vigilance committees, which too often devolved into lynch mobs.
Now, let's get to Mayor Foster's big claim to fame. What was the crime that took place in 1854 that precipitated the actions of this lynch mob?
So in 1854, a man named David Brown stabbed and killed one of his friends, which was common at the time. A vigilance committee came together and decided that they should lynch David Brown. Well, Mayor Foster intervened and he said, wait a minute, let's not lynch the guy. Let's try to let the courts do their job. And as part of his effort to convince the mob, he said, look, if the courts don't do their job, I'll resign as mayor and I'll lead the lynching party myself. And based on that representation, the crowd dispersed and they let the courts do their job. And interestingly enough, the courts did do their job. Brown was tried and he was convicted and sentenced to be hanged. But a day before the hanging, a word got to Los Angeles that the California Supreme Court had issued a stay of the execution.
A stay of the execution. So really, in the most dramatic way possible, right? Brown's life is saved. But as it happened back in those days, the vigilantes decided to take matters into their own hands. So what happened January 11th, 1855?
So upon hearing that the court had stayed the execution, the Vigilance Committee got together and met at a saloon, and various speeches were made decrying the injustice as they saw it. So they decided to take a vote, and they voted to lynch Brown.
And true to his word, Mayor Foster resigned to lead the lynch mob himself. Take us through that.
Exactly. The next day, a group of men show up at the jail, and Stephen Foster is there. And true to his word, he resigns as mayor, picks up an axe along with some of the other men, knock down the door and take Brown out and proceed to lynch him.
Wow. Just like that. And with, wow, with no repercussions, or did they face any repercussions?
None at all. In fact, a couple weeks later, they had an election for mayor, and Stephen Foster was reelected as mayor by large numbers.
So everyone, knowing what he did, they still just gladly reelected him.
Not only that, after he served as mayor, Foster actually served a few terms as a county board of supervisor.
Wow. So this is what L.A. was like right back then. It's, you know, it sounds strange to hear now, but essentially that's how crimes were handled back then.
Very much so. There was no real formalized law enforcement. So, you know, you could call it self-help, or too often it devolved into lynch law. But lynchings were pretty common in Los Angeles. The last lynchings took place in 1871 during the Chinese massacre. It was a human atrocity, but it was also a PR disaster for the city, and the city really worked on becoming more of a modern city. In 1869, you get a formalized law enforcement, and the LAPD starts. The Transcontinental Railroad comes in 1880, and then Los Angeles starts to become the city that we know today.
That's Robert Peterson, host of the Hidden History of Los Angeles podcast. He spoke with us today about the legacy of Mayor Stephen Foster, the first American mayor of Los Angeles. Robert, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much.
Take Two is coming to a close here. I've been Libby Denkman sitting in for A. Martinez today. Coming up tomorrow on Take Two, we'll take you to a hospital in Torrance where they're bearing the brunt of the rise in COVID cases we're seeing in L.A. right now. Plus, we'll check in on California politics, on state of affairs, and get you set for your weekend. It can be safe and fun, I promise. Sometimes it doesn't feel like that. Again, Libby Denkman in for A. Martinez. Thanks so much for joining us. I'll be back tomorrow. Someday when the world is much brighter. Ooh, child, things are gonna be